To Work and to Love, A Theology of Creation, a book written by Dorothée Zolle with Shirley A. Cloyce. And I just wanted to go on to the first session. We primarily dealt with who we are in relationship to God. You know, that God, her position is that God created out of a desire for relatedness, out of a need to be in relationship. And she took us through the difficulties in praising God as the God of creation, and her own personal struggle, theological struggle, from the Christological sense to that which also includes God as creator. And I believe we talked a bit about the third chapter, which is Made from Dust, and about how we have been created out of, we were created as a part of the whole creation, and how we share with all of creation. And the fourth chapter is really titled Created in God's Image. And she begins this chapter with an experience at the seminary when, after a chapel talk, one of the other women came up to her and said to her, Dorothée, my co-creator. And she said that she was really stunned by that word, because the whole understanding, you know, of creation, she had never experientially thought of herself as a co-creator or as a creator. And it wasn't a word, she said, that she would have used in a personal sense. But it started her thinking about that. And what she would get into, it's so hard to get used to hearing horns honking. It's the whole premise, and we talked about this yesterday, was that creation is ongoing. That there are some who have this image of God as the clockmaker who put it all together, set all of the gears, and then left it to continue on its own. I don't believe that that's necessarily how we understand it, but that there are some who have a sense that God is no longer involved in the ongoingness of it, that it's sort of a natural order of things, and it'll eventually wind down. And then it'll be all over.
With us too, in our lives as people?
She would probably say we are never apart from that creation. But that, yes, all of that, that we are, certainly have a limited lifespan. Yeah.
God has
put everything in motion. Yeah, we're a part of that.
Okay. He's kind of abandoned us then too.
In that sense, in the creative sense. Yeah, not in the sense, I mean, she's not saying that God has done that at all, but I don't even know that those who believe in God as the clockmaker image would say that. You know, that God is certainly present in the lives, but not so much in the creative energy that comes out of who we are as human beings. She said, we all have a sense that God created out of nothing, that in the beginning there was chaos, and out of that chaos came order. And what she's saying is that there still is chaos, and there is still a sense of nothingness, which then says that there needs to be, that there must be an ongoing creative energy, because we're still looking at and experiencing nothingness, and we need to be in touch with that nothingness.
I don't quite understand that nothingness.
Okay.
How does she explain that?
One of the things she says there are two, what she has are two different kinds of nothingness. That which we find within ourselves, and she said we most frequently experience that in adolescence. You know, when you kind of go from childhood into adolescence, or from, you know, into puberty, and that whole sense of not being anybody, not being, you know, being nothing. And how we struggle with that, and how we work in terms of finding out who we are in relationship to ourselves, in relationship to God, in relationship to each other. That is a real period. And I worked with taught school for a while with eighth graders. That's an incredible age. So painful. It's, you know, it's this lost time of struggle. And I think we do that. People who have been divorced talk about that emptiness, that abandonment, that sense that God is, you know, is just not there any longer because they're in so much pain. And so we do experience nothingness in our lives, even beyond adolescence. I mean, loneliness, a sense of disconnectedness from each other, from God. I think we all experience an abandonment from God at different times in our lives. And that's nothingness. It's like there is nothing there. The other part of nothingness, she says, is that which is destructive and evil in the world. And she will equate that again with the potential to destroy the created order with the nuclear power. And so there's that big, wide nothingness. And there's also and chaos that surrounds the fear of that happening. And then that personal nothingness that we also experience. And then so she takes that and she says that if we are really co-creators, we have to deal with the nothingness that threatens to swallow us up. And then she asks this question, and this is a question I thought I would ask us. Will God become less important if we think of ourselves as co-creators with God?
More important.
How?
Well, I think that when you feel a part of something, you put a lot of energy into it. You feel that you, there's nothing you can do about anything, and you withdraw. And then that, you do get more of that void and nothingness. And that's why people put up with a lot of suffering, a lot of things that they just would not really logically put up with, is because of fear of abandonment, which is really big fear.
Abandonment from God?
People. God.
Mm-hmm.
People just put up with lots and lots of things.
Yeah.
Keep connected.
And God does figure in there. God is, there's an experience of being abandoned by God, I think, in that, not just by other people, but in being abandoned by other people, we also experience God's abandonment.
I think that happens a lot of times in depression, people that experience depression. And that one poem, I think, has a lot of meaning to those kinds of people that says, you know, the man that walked in the desert, and there was two sets of footprints.
Yes.
And then when there was one set of footprints, the person asked, well, why did you leave me in such a desperate time? And he said, well, that's when I carried you. So that has a lot of meaning to people who are dying,
mm-hmm.
or who are suffering, you know, very strong depressions or chronic diseases.
Yeah, it does. I've used that a couple of times in sermons in the congregation, mm-hmm. and people always comment on that after. Because that is their experience, especially, you know, in that sense, the widows mm-hmm. or widowers, you know, who have just recently lost somebody, you know, and there's just, they can't do it themselves, and they don't even know that somebody else is doing it for them until after.
Right.
Yeah. So for you, being a co-creator, that isn't a frightening or a challenge, not, I shouldn't say challenging, but it doesn't cause you to question her theology. Does it for...
Well, let me just ask. When you use the term co-creator, I guess I thought at first you were using it in the same, in the way of you and I are both co-creators.
Mm-hmm.
But are you using it primarily in the sense of God and I are
mm-hmm.
co-creators?
Mm-hmm. That's how she's using it. Okay.
I guess I just... You know, it puts us almost... Now, I understand what sense she's using it in, mm-hmm. but I think there's a danger somehow in talking like this, because it puts God down at our level, or it brings us up to God's level, which God is definitely a higher being than you or I.
Mm-hmm.
So I somehow have a little bit of a trouble hearing, you know, co-creators. But yet, I understand what she's saying. You know, in that it's an ongoing sort of a thing, and we're here, we're, you know, involved in it. But just wanted to
say
that. No, no, I think I share your feeling, because I think I feel that I'm not sure God's using me. Now, I feel a responsibility to do some things in this world,
right.
But I don't particularly feel that God's using me. Now, again, I'm not sure if that's the same as sense as co-creator or not, but I think there is some of that.
A sense that God uses me to participate in the ongoingness.
I think the idea that we are co-workers with God. Now, what's different about the word co-worker?
That's different. I think co-worker and co-creator. Creator is like creator. I mean, the creator of the earth, you know. I mean, that's a biggie.
So, yeah, you're thinking it's finished once it's created. Didn't that imply?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
It's not
okay. Which, this is what she says about this. She says, the more a person develops her creativity, delves into the power of, or the project of liberation, and transcends her own limitations, the more God is God. God does not cling to creational power, making it his possession, but sharing it, knowing that good power is shared power. Does that? Then she uses a. She said the Hebrew Bible uses the verb to create only in relation to God. It contains bold descriptions of human actions using metaphors for creational power. And then she quotes from Isaiah 58. Is not this the fact that I choose to loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call the Lord, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, Here I am. If you take away from the midst of you the yoke, the pointing of the finger and speaking wickedness, if you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness, and your gloom be as a noonday. And the Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your desire with good things and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairers of the breach, the restorers of streets to dwell in. She said, the question is, who will be the repairer of the breach and the restorer of the streets to dwell in? Who will continue creation? So she takes, certainly in Isaiah, there's a real sense of God being involved, God being the enabler, God being the empowerment, but that God empowers us to be the ones who repair the breach, who restore the streets, and to do that in a sense of real caring and compassion for the hungry, the poor, the oppressed. And in that, we share that power with God. It is a shared power. It is not an equal power. It is a shared power. She would never say it's an equal power.
But it does not come from us.
It comes
that's
out of.
I have a
okay,
it does
okay.
Not come from within ourselves, it comes definitely from God. God is our power source down here.
God is the power in relationship, yeah. God is the power that enables us to be. God's image, God's the manifestation of God to other people and to the rest of creation. God is always holier, but we are also holy.
Because God is holy.
Yeah, we wouldn't make ourselves holy.
We are chosen and given the Spirit.
Yeah. But we have a hard time, I think, imaging ourselves as imitations of God. And to claim that and to say, I am God's image. And in me, or in all of us, it's the only image the world has of God. So in that sense, I need to claim more of a relationship with God and more of a sense that God has given me the power to be creative. And I may not do it always the way in which God would have done it. But I'm still doing it because I'm empowered by God to do it. I suppose that sounds a little confused.
Sometimes
I start thinking I'm preaching.
We sometimes get, I believe, off track by using this word creativity rather loosely or broadly, because in the most strict sense, only God can create. And all we can do is to discover aspects of his creation. And I like to think of my relationship to God. Elmer the other day put that list of things on the board that everybody suggests. Where do they see God? And it was interesting. I thought that I was the only one who said in myself. And from that I mean the subjective concept of God versus the objective. We see God only in these, in nature and in electricity and things, as long as subjectively there is a God in my awareness. Without that, I can make abstract acknowledgement without necessarily feeling tied to God in this awareness. And I can't quite see how people can feel abandoned by God if they have a clear subjective feel for God. And the creativity, I like to make the analogy that if you have a flashlight in your hand, and if it always will work, and God and Jesus says, I am the light of the world. If it is always going to work, it's guaranteed 100% of the time it's going to work. I'm never going to be in the darkness, period. As long as I'm going to turn that switch on, I got the power to do it, because I've been given that power to turn that light on. Now, in no way did I make that battery or that flashlight or that bulb or have even the capacity to do it. But it's been put into my hand and I can use it as I will. I do not have to feel abandoned. If I want to push that thing away or lose it or do something, I have that power. But I also have the power to retrieve it and to use it and to call upon it. And so the subjective sharing of creativity, I don't think of it as creativity, I just think of it as sharing the awareness of whatever little in the cosmos that the curtain's been drawn for me as an individual. Certainly each of us has different quantities of this. You sometimes wonder how some big scientist who knows so much, how can he be ignorant of things? But we realize that there isn't anybody, however wise, who doesn't have just a thimbleful more than I do, for example, in God's eyes. So no matter how creative we may think things are, and no matter how clever or ingenious we see things are, they're going to be pretty obsolete in another 100 years.
Okay, when I hear creation in that respect, I'm hearing you talk about creating things, objects.
Well,
is that right?
They're interrelated.
Yeah.
They're interrelated because this building was trees at one time. And we just made it into a building. And each of these things, everything that we feel that's material, is actually some form of the creative mass and energy which we have merely, by following the right rules and laws, have been able to use.
Okay, but I see. I don't hear her talking so much about making things, creating out of create. I don't hear her saying that it's possible for us or even necessary for us to make a tree, to create a tree, to create life. I hear her talking about ways in which we become co-creators with God in terms of ideas, in how we might in ways in which we touch people and heal them, in ways in which we hopefully can undo or stop the progression towards total destruction. Not by making things, out of nothing, but of making life more livable, more wonderful than it presently is.
Well, the ideas probably come from God also, don't they?
I would guess, certainly they do. Certainly they do.
Actually, you aren't creating anything. You ask for ideas, you pray for them, and for a path. And if it comes, and when it comes, many pastors will say that in their sermons, that the idea comes from God. And sometimes we classify the idea as preposterous or impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas actually, we aren't really in a position to judge most of the time.
She would disagree with that. She would say that we limit ourselves by saying, I cannot do, I mean, that's something I have no control over, or that we can't judge about certain kinds of concepts or certain ideas or certain things that we think we cannot do. We can. That we limit ourselves by that.
In terms of views, I have problems with what you were saying in the sense that to me it comes too close to giving God credit for everything, and along with that goes blame, and I don't happen to do that in my beliefs. What puzzles me on this so far is that this concept of creation, which I guess my concept has been that initial, has been that.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, if you'd let me add into it then what I view as development.
Okay.
Development of the world, it seems to me, is what she also is including in the concept of creation.
Yeah, she is. And I suspect that one of the reasons why she's using the... why she's chosen the word creation is because it is so offensive to us. And it's a challenge to let go of some of our traditional theology, which we sometimes connect our theology to our faith. You know, our faith is determined, well, I think our faith is determined by our theology, but we can be challenged and still be faithful people. And I suspect, I don't know, she doesn't ever say that, but because she has been struggling with, you know, with images of God, and she's been very involved in, as I understand her writings, in anti-war movements for a long, long time.
Coming from Germany after
the war. Oh, you bet, yeah.
The war.
Yeah. And so, and then social justice issues are... in terms of oppression, she's been a person who's traveled to like Nicaragua and El Salvador and other areas of Central America. She lives in one of the most multicultural, most depressed cities, New York. You know, right? She lives, I suppose, in Manhattan or Brooklyn or someplace, because she teaches in Manhattan. And so she also experiences, you know, she makes occasional visits to Harlem. And, you know, so in her life, she was raised in a middle class German family that was not a religious family, and came to it later in her life.
Yeah. You were saying that she is working towards stopping this oppression, this, you know, awfulness in the world. Mm-hmm. What does she say about that? How are we to do that?
Well, hopefully. If I ever get through this book. There are two parts in the back. One is on work and one is on love. And she says we do it by how we understand ourselves as workers and lovers. Okay? And so, but first I thought it would be helpful for us to at least try to grapple with the background or the foundation for what happens when she gets into the areas of work and the areas of love. So that's why I'm doing this. One of her statements is that we are not mere vessels into which grace is poured, that we are living parts of active love. And she has quoted a woman who is Nicaraguan, who has written a commentary on the Lord's Prayer. And in response to the word, "Holy be your name," or hallowed be your name, as we're more comfortable saying it. To make something holy, then, doesn't mean to chant, to say prayers, to have processions, to read the Bible. Making the name of God holy means to love others, to do something for others. If we set to glorifying God just with prayers and processions as we used to, we're not making God holy at all. In other words, to make love real is to make the name of God holy, or to make his person known here on earth, even though maybe the name of God won't even be mentioned. It comes out of the Gospel in Soltaname, written by a Nicaraguan peasant woman, those words. And Zola's response to that is, she said, the woman's understanding of God's holiness stresses not separation, but unification between God and the human being. To make something holy is to make justice real. Cardinal suggests that holy be your name might better be translated as, may your person be known, or may you be acknowledged doing justice. And so that's how we recognize how holy God is by how holy we are in response to the needs of the poor and the oppressed. Then she talks also about that we have two different understandings of God. One of you were talking about the God who's out there and the God who is in here. There's the otherness of God and the sameness of God. That we have, God is the holy other, and God and humanity may achieve a mystical union. And we've always believed in sort of a mystical union, you know, between God and humanity. Not really totally understanding that. That's why it's called mystical, I think. It's because we never totally understand that, but we do believe that we have a unity with God. That we receive that in our baptism. That we experience it in the sharing of the Eucharist. That which makes God other is that there's always a distance between us and God. And it's like God is up there. Whenever somebody says, you know, go up to heaven or go up to God, I think maybe is that what you were sort of talking about? That God isn't up there or out there. For you.
Well, that's right. Yeah. The God has to be inside your psyche and awareness for him to have any specific application to your life.
Yeah. To be a part of your life. To move you.
Not have any meaning at all. Yeah. Otherwise, it's an idol because you have one of these things on the wall or something that you look at and address as opposed to something that it allows you to see and think as he would have us do.
Just a couple of the things that she has about showing God as other. I never did learn to write on the board very well. So that God is a stranger. She has some other things too. That obedience, sin, in understanding God as the other is primarily idolatry. I can't even do it when I'm reading the book. And disobedience. In the union with God, or the sameness with God, she would have us, we have the birth of God in the soul, there's sort of the depth of this kind of thing as a relationship to. It's that sort of the source, maybe that's another word, source, rather than source of power. Rather than obedience, she would see our empowerment. And I guess, you know, when I look at that, I see this makes more sense to me than this. And that comes out of how I am in relationship to people, too. It's that I don't obey very well at all. But I do respond. You know, and I do, I mean, if I have to consider always my relationship to God as always obeying God, then I'm always a child. Well, we are children in relationship to God, but I'm always rebellious, I suspect. But if I experience God as treating me like someone who's important, then I'm empowered by God and I will work for God. Not out of a sense of fear, but out of a sense of love. And that's where this word means more to me than this one, because I'm working out of a sense of real, genuine response to the gifts that God has given me. I am empowered to give those back.
How about responsibility then, though?
Well, see, I would drop. Yeah, I would say that I have a responsibility, but I will not. I don't see myself acting simply because it's a responsibility. It's more a response. And for me, you know, I mean, I hear the word responsibility.
Maybe response and responsibility must have the same base. Those two words.
Once I checked that out, and I'm not sure they should. To me, it feels like it. Yeah. Sin here is alienation, and it is emptiness. And another word she uses is despair. I was going to call you Julie. It's just Jill.
Bob, this matter of responsibility, I can't see how we can disassociate that from this talents like we were discussing in the previous one, where God has given us these talents. We really, as individuals, don't know to what extent our talent has been, because we find that we have talents that we didn't realize we had. And as we use these and as we apply this nebulous thing called ideas and thought and so forth, learning, as we apply this, we find that we have less knowledge of some things but more talent. And the responsibility for the use of these talents is on each of us as individuals. There is no way in the world that we can transfer that to our teachers or our parents,
mm-hmm,
or our preachers or somebody else. As individuals, we have that responsibility. Jesus didn't say that this guy's CPA was in some way responsible because he did not make enough with his talent, or he made so much more with his talent. And as Elmer said, it isn't really materials that he's talking about, it's faith,
mm-hmm,
or whatever. I would say awareness of God, a translating in our own mind of everything we look at in terms of God's power. And that the responsibility, though, we're not shifting responsibility to anybody. He's given us these things. Like I say, we really don't know what they are. Because when we see something in somebody else, we realize, well, gosh, maybe I've got some of that, you know? And only by trying can you find out what,
mm-hmm,
you can do.
Yeah.
So then we respond in different ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We usually pray for the strength and wisdom to proceed. Not long ways that we have trepidation on, because we may feel that, oh, gee, that's not my field, I don't know. We don't have any specific field. I really don't believe it. In rare cases, I can't quite feel for this calling that people have.
Or what one call.
What the heck is that? It's merely a thing you feel comfortable with. You find your comfort zone over here, and you jump in there, and you move around in there, and hey, that's my calling. That's not necessarily so. Moses certainly didn't feel called to lead the people of Israel, and yet he certainly did a heck of a job. And at no time did he really agree that that was one of his things.
Nor did Jonah.
No. Time and time again.
Jonah's my favorite story. Jonah, who wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I won't do this. Okay, I'll do it. But then when he did it and it worked, he got mad. He went and sat under a tree. You know, because he did what God told him to do because he didn't want to be thrown out of the boat anymore. But, you know, and still he was upset because it worked.
Yeah. Well, and Paul happened to face these people, that these two powers, so to speak, those he persecuted versus those he was representing, to take a complete jump across the chasm there, like you snap your finger, that's just, it just seems to be impossible for a person to do that. And the guts that it would take, you know, to do that. You and I can say, well, I can do that. Well, he wouldn't have been able to do that either, except that at the right and appropriate time,
it just happened.
God communicated with him, and I'm sure he does that with us, and we need to call on the Holy Spirit to keep doing this and renewing this in us.
And sometimes I think we do not know until after we've done it that that's what we were called to do. I mean, I don't experience my call into ministry in the sense of knowing that, I mean, it wasn't some sort of a spiritual event in my life. It was a very practical move for me. But having been in it, it feels, for at least right now, it feels like the right place. This is where God wants me to be, and this is what I'm about. And everything came together in being, you know, a pastor. But I was also a teacher, and when I was a teacher, I felt the same way. So I keep moving into different kinds of things. And I suspect that it isn't so much the profession as it is doing with whatever it is that I have at that particular moment in my life to do it. Is that what you're saying?
It'd be nice if everybody could receive some kind of call, like Luther,
yeah,
or Paul, or somebody like that. And no one knows how many actually do.
Yeah. One of the things that, and hopefully I'll get to this, is that when she talks about work and how we understand work and how we understand call, you know, is that most work is alienation. That most workers feel alienated, I mean, I should say. That the jobs that most people do are not jobs that most people like doing.
I don't know if that's a helpful concept. I don't know if it's so in the first place. Yeah. In second place, I think it's not a helpful concept.
I agree with Bob.
Well, let's wait. I just have a couple more things I want to say about creation and definitions of God, and then we'll really deal with that. She uses another woman theologian whose definition of God equals power in relationship, or power in relation. One of the things that feminist theologians have been trying to do in their grappling with relationship and language in theology is to find a way to language our experience with God apart from only the male image. I mean, God is male, but God is also female. God is more than male, more than female. You know, God is. So how do we language, what kinds of words do we use for God? In the Hebrew scriptures, Yahweh was not ever used. Because you did not name God. They had all other kinds of names and images for God in the Hebrew scriptures. It's unfortunate that we as Christians, I think, have used the word Yahweh for God because we are, in a sense, stepping on our Jewish brothers and sisters' concept that if you named God, you died. I mean, it was sort of that God was just too much holy other. And so Yahweh is not used as a part of their ritual and so forth. But, so they had other ways. God as creator, God as mother, God as father, God as warrior. You know, God has been used in nouns, but God also can be a verb. And so the woman who calls God as power in relation is a woman named Carter Hayward. And I haven't read any of her work, so I don't know, but she uses her a lot. She also then talks about that we need a sense of wonderment, that we need a sense of joy. She says, children and artists are the teachers of the spirituality of creation. I believe that. That's one statement I will really. Because children and artists are the teachers of the spirituality of creation. Because they can see, you know, children, most children, not all children, but most children have a sense of wonderment and curiosity, and they're always asking why, and they, you know, they can get real pleasure out of watching. Stephen, this little two-year-old, loves ants. And he just, his eyes get big, and he follows them, and he picks them up, and he holds them in his hand, and he watches them move. And he's curious, and he's alive with all these little things, and he chases birds. You know, I mean, he has a sense about him that when he's doing that, the rest of us are kind of going, you know, we're just alive too. And artists are those, it can be a very lonely profession, I think. I've heard that from people who are artists, because they're always seeing things that the rest of us don't see. No? And they want us to see it. And they want us to have that same sense of awe. But we miss it. And so when she says that children and artists are the teachers of the spirituality of creation, it's because it comes from within. It's that gift of wonderment, the gift of awe. And then she says, one cannot love God if one does not know what beauty is.
What
beauty is. Is that a thing we might agree with?
Well, Helen saw a fish the other day that she said was a beautiful fish, and I said a fish to me is not beauty.
What is fish? Food?
Well, it's just something that, you know, now that Holstein cow out there was beautiful.
Are you a farmer?
Yeah. Animals are number one.
This is a poem by Ernesto Cardenal. He was questioned on how he came to be a poet, a priest, and a revolutionary, gave as his first reason love of beauty. This led him, he said, to poetry and beyond. It led him to God and beyond. It led him to the gospel and beyond. It led him to socialism and beyond. How weak a love of beauty must be that is content with house beautiful. How trivial a love of poetry that stops with the text. How small a love of God that becomes sated in him, not hungrier. How little we love the gospel if we keep it to ourselves. How powerless are socialistic yearnings if they fear to go beyond what will be. She said the most terrifying quality about the life of the broken person is the absence of joy. And again, when you deal with depressed people or people who are grieving, there is a real absence of joy. And religion, faith, creation-centered spirituality, as she would experience it, would give us that sense of joy. But she also says that we need not to be too sentimental about it, because there's a lot to be in despair about in the world. You know, and there is, if we have seen it, if we have been in ghettos in our cities in this country, or if we have visited other countries that have extremely low levels of poverty. If we visited, and I did just 2 days, a country like Russia that has never recovered from the destruction of World War II. Incredible number of buildings and things that, you know, their economy is military based, and I suspect that most of their money goes into that, but they have never recovered from the destruction and the deaths. There's a whole generation of women and no men in Russia. They lost so many men. More so than we did. Because, obviously more than we did, because it was right there. But just an incredible kind of image, you know, to see all these old women in church.
How does she explain why this is happening? Does she have, you know, why?
What, you mean why there is this in the world? It's, she doesn't say, she I think assumes that most of us understand why it's in the world. She doesn't say that. But it is a power, it is that desire to be in control. Our control.
Generally, what is the problem here?
What is it that you assume is the problem?
Sin.
Okay, and so you would say sin is idolatry and disobedience, as opposed to sin as alienation, emptiness, and despair. Okay. That there really is for you a sense that we are inherently evil, that we have, that even though we were created by God, we are also evil?
Well.
And where does our evil come from?
We were created in God's image. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And he, at the very beginning, he said, okay, you've got these, he gave us guidelines, and he gave us direction. He gave us a choice whether to be in union with him,
mm-hmm.
or whether not to be in union with him. And we chose not to. That was our choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're sinners. We sin. There's sin in us as people. Well, he gave us Jesus to bridge
to
that.
To take care of that.
But yet, there's still sin there, but there's a way out of that sin.
You're not going to like this next part. When you brought up that, I'm going to skip over to this part about sin, what she says about sin, and what she says about the fall.
Okay.
And you,
I'm ready.
Okay. I found this kind of exciting, but it's certainly still a struggle for me. She says, interpreting the Genesis narrative as an etiological explanation for original sin, etiological for those who don't know what it means cause of, I had to look it up. So I thought, E-T-I-O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L, etiological, means cause of original sin. It's a term that does not appear in the story of the fall. It doesn't. It's not there. It was a term that was developed by the early Christian, or early church fathers. It wasn't there. Okay. Seems to be an all-too-orthodox reading of a myth that speaks about our development as responsible, now we got your word, human beings, who have to make choices between good and evil instead of living in a dreaming consciousness, in the words of Kierkegaard.
Can I just say something real quick?
Mm-hmm.
She uses the word myth.
Mm-hmm.
Is that implying that this is a myth?
Myth, in theological terms, myth does not mean something that is untrue.
Okay, what does it mean?
It means a story or a development of an idea or of a concept that comes out of our tradition, out of our history, out of our experience.
Somehow that implies this is okay, this is truth. Is she still saying that this is true?
That God created the world, yes. That
the
God
is truth. Is she saying?
She doesn't ever say that. No.
Okay.
She doesn't.
Hold on. Sorry.
She never doesn't say it isn't either. But this is, okay, now she's talking about when a child learns to say no to her parents or other authorities, it is a sign of the humanness of this little person. She has chosen to be free by saying no. This is the only path by which she may truly, at a later point, be able to say yes. Therefore, there's no yes without a no. Therefore, the talk about the disobedience of Adam and Eve is misleading, as if they could have remained obedient just by refraining from eating the forbidden fruit of the tree. We ought to cease understanding this confrontation with the authority of the Father. This cutting of the umbilical cord is sin. The story of the fall is in many ways the story of a rise in human development rather than the story of our fall into guilt and sin. The myth mirrors the guilt all of us experience in growing up, making our own choices, leaving the commanding father who wants to keep his trees for himself, along with the womb of our mother, symbolized by the nourishing waters of paradise and our symbiotic life within it. But there is no way to become an adult while remaining in a dreaming consciousness and in symbiotic attachment to the womb. The story talks about what it means to grow up. is kind of her sense. There is no way to mature without breaking away from the parent, without causing pain to the one who remains behind, and without guilt. So she's not saying that they shouldn't have felt or experienced guilt in their choice. But what she also says is there's no painless or guilt-free path to adulthood. You just can't go from childhood to adulthood without experiencing pain and guilt. And that's what the biblical story of the fall is all about.
So she's using nowadays, or what's the situation in the world today, to explain
that human nature is such that in order for us to grow up, to become adults, we have to learn how to say no. We have to learn to experience what it's like to not always do what somebody else tells us to do, and do it ourselves to determine and to take kind of responsibility for ourselves. We have to, you know, she says, the moral option we face is not a choice between obedience and disobedience. The only choice we have is to disobey, to eat of the tree of knowledge, and then to live through the hardships of life. But she also says that God, you know, Adam and Eve disobeyed God. I mean, God said, do not eat of this tree. Eve thought, well, why not? I mean, that's the story. This is the way it's presented to us in the scripture. She took the risk. She tried it, and she found out what it was all about. And Adam took her word for it. Sure, okay, I'll try it. And they both found out what it was all about. That they knew more than they wanted to know. But God did not abandon them. You see, they disobeyed. They didn't do what they were supposed to do. And that God changed. The relationship with God changed there. But God did not abandon them. And my relationship to my Father has changed. But my Father still loves me, only differently now, after years of being gone out of his house. And my mother loves me differently now after all these years of being gone out of her house. I am no longer living my life in obedience. I have many things I'm doing my parents would never have done. Right? And isn't that true with all of us? The good things I do, even and the bad things I've done, are not their responsibility. And it's not, you know, I had to say no to their way of life. In a way, in order for me to become an adult. Now, I haven't said no to their whole way of life or all of the things they taught me, but I had to leave them in order to find out who I am. And that's kind of what she says about Adam and Eve. And I thought, well, that's a new way of looking at it. It is more of a sense of mature, looking at how we reach maturity. I think we sometimes want not to have to face pain and not to deal with guilt. But I think it's pain and guilt that teach us what is right.
Did she mention Kierkegaard in there?
Kierkegaard, yeah. Kierkegaard is the one who said, talked about dreaming consciousness. She used his term, dreaming consciousness. So that we're sort of in this, he's an existentialist, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Yeah. I haven't read much of Kierkegaard. I could hardly say it. Kierkegaard is a Danish philosopher.
Susan, have you come across Paul Tournier's little book, Secrets?
I haven't, no.
That's on that same theme, that a child must keep some secrets from their parents
mm-hmm.
before he can
mature. That's right. There was a little girl here on staff, or the Martins. They had a child who was 4, Claire. And she is the most assertive 4-year-old I have ever seen. Well, for a long time, anyway. And Claire knew her limits. She was also sometimes obnoxious and difficult to deal with. I shouldn't say obnoxious, but she was the kind of child that we would say, you know, she's going to have to be knocked down a few pegs. I mean, I heard that said, and I would disagree, because Claire was able to say, no, I don't want you to pick me up. I don't want to do that. I want to do this. Now, maybe there were times when we'd have to say, well, in this particular place and time, you cannot do that because it's not safe for you, or because there are other people who are involved, and to help her learn that. But she was determined, and she was assertive, and there were times when she was so tired of all of these adults, and all she wanted to be with were her mother and her father. When you live in a community, I mean, when you're a four-year-old and your friends are anywhere between 25 and 85, you know, that's an unusual place for a child to be. But she could say no when people would reach over to help her tie her shoes. No, I want my mom to do that. And it was true. She just got tired of having all these mothers and fathers. She learned to say no very early. And she was allowed to say no. And that was real important for her. She'll also have to learn how to say yes. But she'll learn how to say yes from having learned how to say no, according to Dorothy Zola.
I like that. What Dorothy said, there, if you're allowed to say yes, you're allowed to say no.
And sometimes in saying no, it's the wrong answer. But we don't know that until we've done it. It says, Christian orthodoxy, she says, is possessed by a dread of disobedience. And I wonder if that's true. Then she goes on to say, we are called to choose freedom over a childlike obedience, to choose the intricacies and difficulties of work and sexual life over childhood's playful simulations of both, to choose conflict over harmony, and to journey into the other world, or into the world, despite our intense longing to remain home and to forfeit our adulthood. If we affirm our adulthood and think about ourselves, not just Adam and Eve, as having eaten of the forbidden fruit, then we may come to appropriate both our sexuality and our work life, not simply as a curse, but in their full, often conflicting dimensions. A curse on work and sexuality hovers over our remembrance of a garden of good love and good work. We have to deal with both traditions. It does not help us to pronounce the world inside the orchard obedient and the hostile world of the wilderness disobedience. Her chapter on work, which kind of helps get us into that, deals with that we have been taught, and I remember this, that work is a curse. It was the curse that was laid on Adam and Eve for their disobedience. And so we have to do it because of them. No, I learned that as a child in Sunday school.
As cause and effect?
Yeah.
As cause and effect.
Yeah, that work, you know, you don't have to enjoy what you do. You don't have to enjoy it. You just, yeah, it's a penalty for sin. For Adam and Eve's sin, we work because they sinned. It also became for women, I don't know, all the generations. I shared this a couple weeks ago with another group, and younger women, those under 35 probably, or under 30, I'm not sure, have never probably heard this or had it, you know, but in terms of menstruation, my aunts and my mother
called
it the curse.
Sure they did.
And they believed it was. You know, and what does that tell us about our bodies and how our bodies function, you know, and the joy of becoming a woman, you know, which is a part of that, you know, that the onset of menses is that sense of I'm no longer, you know, I'm moving into adulthood. And I know what's going on in my body and it feels really good. And I've got an aunt over here who says, oh, she's got the curse. You know, gotta stay away from her today. She's, you know, and all of the things that are attached to women because of that. You know, there are certain jobs we're not supposed to have to do, and obviously there are certain times of the month when we're harder to get along with than others, and that's true sometimes. You know, that is true sometimes. But, you know, it's not bad. It's good. But there were whole generations of women who believed it was bad. In the Old Testament, they were unclean. For 7 days, you couldn't go near a woman. If you touched her, you were unclean, and you had to go off by yourself and go through all of these things. Those were the two, you know. Adam had to work, and Eve had to bear children. And a part of that, you know, was that every month, for at least for a whole week, she was ousted from the community. So Dorothy Zola is working at trying to get us to recapture our sense of who we are as human beings, working and loving as being good. Our sexuality as being good and our work as being good. What time is it? How are we doing? Got a little bit of time. I want to show you a picture that was at the beginning of this chapter and ask you, it's called The Treadmill. I was going to have Susan blow it up, but I couldn't
find it. Called Stress and Fatigue. Yeah.
The wood cutting.
That looked familiar. Ever felt like this?
No?
Sure.
I was going to ask just to kind of where is it? I knew I wrote something down. Oh, okay. What does it conjure up for you, this person on the treadmill?
Not getting any place, to me, is the concept.
Completely out of control. Yeah, that's true. Well, he was getting exercise.
Frustration.
Well, the expression
on his
face.
Okay, I can show it. You can just sort of pass it around and look at it a little bit if you want. Frustration.
Repetition.
Repit.
Well, what'd you say? Tired.
Tired.
T-I. Repetition.
Hopeless.
Many of you ever felt like you were on a treadmill?
Have you, Susan?
Oh yeah. I think probably one of the times was when I was in college. And I had a job. I worked 36 hours a week.
36 hours?
Yeah, in a bank, listing checks on an adding machine.
Yeah.
Taped up, double taped them. Every night I had trays like this full of payroll checks that had to be listed so they could be posted to. This was pre-computer days. You know?
Yeah.
And, sitting at this adding machine with big wire things of checks, and then just sitting there going, you know, turning the checks over. I don't think I could even do it anymore. But, you know, always putting the figures and then putting them all, and the stacks were like this. You know, they'd come in during the day in the bank. People would come in to cash their checks, and then they were all sent up into bookkeeping, and that's where I worked. And then I have to do it twice. And I had like a whole set of, you know, different accounts. And so many, I was responsible for so many of those things, and they had to be done before I could leave, and they had to be double taped and sometimes, many, many times, you know, you make mistakes. So then you have to read the, you know, look over the tapes to see where the mistake was. And that's, you know, every day for 2 years, or no, for 1 year, every night for 1 year, for 9 months at least, I did that. And the thing that I experienced is that I knew, for me, that was temporary. But there were a whole group of women that I worked with who were doing it for income. I mean, that was their life. And they had been doing this for like 7, 8 years, some of them. Some of them had moved from adding the tapes, you know, to the bookkeeping machine, which was a little bit more enjoyable because then you had the statements, you know, and then you could put all these things onto the statement and then balance at the end of the night. And I did learn to do that eventually, but it's that kind of, oh, meaninglessness, sense of, you know, kind of just rolling it out. So yeah, that's one experience. I think I've probably had others.
See, to me, that's boredom, and it's different from the treadmill, and different from the not getting any fits, because you're bored and all sorts of other, monotonous, and you can say all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. But you do have someplace else, you know, you're going.
They didn't.
I don't know about their situation. That's, I guess I hesitate to talk about somebody else. Mm-hmm. But it was a means to get someplace for them, too.
It was called supporting their families.
I know.
Yeah.
But was that the only thing?
Fairly important.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely that's important. You know, you have to support your family. You know, that's. But is that their only source that's keeping them going, that's giving them encouragement in their life, is their job? I think that
they see.
Don't you know people like that?
Yes. Oh, yes, I do. But I think I know a lot of people in that situation who are the most joyful, happy people in the world.
I'm not saying that they were unhappy. I'm saying that they didn't have any sense that there was anything else that they could do with their lives. I mean, they were happy. They were, you know, they were in their place. They knew that's what they could do.
But I've also known people who feel that, because they are Christians, because they have that hope in Jesus, that they, you know, they do have, they can carry out their lives in a hopeful way. They are hopeful. They know that their life is worth living, not only because that the only thing they can do is, you know, factory work or something, you know, but yeah, they are. They do feel that their life is worth more than just that. They do have encouragement. They do have hope. So I think that, yes, there are people like this, mm-hmm. like you're talking about, but I know that there are other.
Have any of you been factory workers?
Been what?
Factory workers?
I was a little slave once.
Were you?
Missouri Bag Company, and when I wasn't doing the switchboard facing this way, I could turn around and type with my extra time, but the switchboard was the primary thing, and I hated it when the switchboard lit up. I wanted to type all the time. Got chewed out for it.
That's good, yeah.
The same kind of thing you did for a while.
Yeah.
It was putting data into a computer all day long. Yeah. Facing a white wall, a computer and typing in addresses.
Yeah, the computer was supposed to take away the drudgery of the job that I did. In fact, I was replaced by a computer. The banks went on computer probably my third year of college, and so I lost my job, too. But it didn't. They're back to shift work again. Now it's data processing. It's the people who sit and do what you did into the computer, so it doesn't. The treadmill Zoli uses as a just to look at the monotonous kind of sense of just the kinds of things we do that are monotonous. I would find housework monotonous, personally. You too? You're not. My mother doesn't. I do. Huh?
When we looked at that picture, I thought of that story by Herman Melville, Bartleby,
His job is, he copies. It's before the typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
All day long, he copies what somebody else has written. And finally, well, I suppose it's a protest. He's protesting. And he finally refuses to eat. And he's protesting, I think, his life work in that there's no creativity in it.
Mm-hmm.
He finally decided that was what the whole story was about.
But there was no
creativity in what he has to do all day long.
Right. There was a time, and then she would say this, there was the time prior to the push for the profit motive and the use of people when everybody had tasks and did them, but for a purpose. And that we've gotten away from that. She has a real, she comes really strong, on strong about capitalism. My sense is that she is that she's definitely anti-capitalist. And that she draws on Marx in some ways in terms of the work that he did in lifting up the worker as opposed to the owner of the business. But I can see there's a change even in the years, my working life years, between what, even like in the 50s when my father was working, you know, and seemed to really, you know, he got a kick out of doing what he was doing, which was, he was a Pullman conductor. So he got to meet lots of people and, you know, and do those kinds of things. It was a rather monotonous job at times, but it was a good job. And he had some kind of a sense of being involved, and he was a union member. But that's even, you know, he lost his job 2 years before retirement. Because the railroads went to Amtrak. And it was this whole thing about profit, you know, we just keep getting more profit-oriented than we are product, you know, and so we produce only for profit. I just came out of an Iron Range community. Spent 4 years as a pastor in a community that produces iron ore. I think I shared this yesterday. And all of those people were just, you know, they're basically puppets. Or marionettes for U.S. Steel and some of the other companies that own those, you know. It's like, we can shut this plant down anytime we want. And they didn't tell them within, you know, more than 2 weeks before. That was happening all the time. And that had not happened all the time in the past. I mean, they had more, when the company owned the town, there was a more of a relationship between the company and the people who worked for the company. They worked together. But then the company just moved out and almost shut the town down.
Is it
going to
get any better?
No. Not as far as the steel, I don't think.
Hibbing?
North of Hibbing, but Hibbing certainly is affected, yeah. All of those communities, just a huge number of people, are chronically now unemployed. And there's lumber industry too, but you know what that's like out here in the West. It's the same there. And then there's the resorts or the, you know, that kind of community. But that, it takes capital to build that.
It seems
the year-round kind of thing.
You know, I recognize there's many things that are monotonous,
mm-hmm.
but to me, versus God inside, really, we want to subscribe to, by and large, a market system, or by and large, sort of three choices: market system, chaos, or some type of stronger government structure than we have.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see what other alternatives are. That's the puzzle to me.
Well, yeah. It's the thing that, I don't know that we need a different government structure. Well, we certainly need less of a structure than what it's become. You know, part of me says that if the church had done its job in the 30s, the 20s and 30s, in terms of taking care of the poor, the hungry, the unemployed, the government wouldn't be doing it today.
That's correct.
But we didn't do it.
That's
so now we have a system that we don't know how to undo. And I don't know if we can either. But multinational corporations, cartels, I mean, it's just, none of us have any control, if you look at it. But she says, that's not the way to talk.
Yeah.